welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Philip Brady. Philip Brady is the author of three previous books of poems, a memoir, and a collection of essays. His work has been awarded the Snyder Prize from Ashland Poetry Press, a gold medal from Forward, an Ohioan Poetry Award, five individual artist fellowships, and a Governor's Award from the Ohio Arts Council, and a Thayer Fellowship. He is executive director of Etruscan Press and professor of English at Youngstown State University. He also teaches in the Low Residency Program at Wilkes University. He plays in the new Celtic band, Brady's Leap. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks so much for having me here today.
Yeah. So as I understand it, you're going to be reading from your new collection?
Yes. This is a book. It's called To Banquet with the Ethiopians, a memoir of life before the alphabet. And it's a verse memoir. So in some ways, it brings together a life, myth, and poetry. So it's 18 chapters telling one story, really, that focuses on a transition that we all make in our lives from childhood to adulthood, which is really from the world of myth to the world of time. The world in myth, children experience time, I think, in a mythic way, the ever eternal present. It's only when we cross over that rocky, terrible Pittsburgh Hill-like crossing into adulthood that we begin to see time as plot, time as narrative, time as mortality. Oftentimes, it's the agency of the alphabet that helps us make that transition. And this book takes that transition also as the basis to recall that our culture made that crossing from myth time into narrative time about 3,000 years ago under the aegis of a person who may or may not have existed, but someone that we call Homer.
Can you begin by reading us some poems?
You bet. Well, I thought I'd begin actually just by starting with the first chapter.
Okay.
The chapter is called Between Moon and Cup. And it takes place in the office of a scrivener, is what I'm calling writers, people who actually make their living writing, recalling his first encounter with the Iliad. So, Between Moon and Cup. On a shelf between the moon and my wine cup, folded in the catalog of ships, I keep a secret list, inventory of everything that happens and does not. At night, in my silent office, I reach up and push aside the artificial plant and tip Fagel's Iliad from its niche. I inscribe, erase, and rearrange. Then I rock, chanting to moon and cup. So that's the beginning. A man in his office recalling what he first experienced in a summer camp when he brought a prose translation of the Iliad by W.H.D. Rouse to his camp. And of course, he tried to read it, but he had a very hard time. He was a young boy, but he understood enough to realize that the Trojan War, with all its intrigue and violence, was somehow being reenacted in his summer camp among these boys, adolescent boys, Lauren. That's really the most violent and horrible of conflicts. We talk about global conflicts, but boys' summer camp is where I think much of the germ of that happens. So that's where the poem begins, and it goes on to say, I'll just do a little bit more from that chapter, when he sees that item, and he's talking about the items on the list, item 265, is a wine dark slash, Urscript, a cave figure or totem. When tilted to the moon, the form dissolves into a child, then a burning city. Finally, a word, a strange name. As best as I make out, it reads Thersites. If this necromantic glyph welting my list conjures a crippled fool from Homer, then drowned is the moon shimmering in my cup, and my heart plying its verse through storms of blood, and the uneasy peace that comes from chanting lists. Before the alphabet locked his name in time, did Homer rock, chanting to moon and cup as I chant lists? Is it to remember or forget? Since verse has been sentenced to be read, hexameters might wash up on a beach anywhere in the last 3,000 years, say, in a clubhouse, in a horseshoe of pine cabins, like my New York Police Athletic League in the distant summer of item 265. Like Thersites, I'd been sent to become a man, though unsteady on my adolescent pins. Again, that's from the first chapter, which sets us in this boy's camp, and which really sets the stage for the three kinds of actions which are happening. One is the boy just learning to be a man through trying to come to terms with all of the violence that he encounters, trying to make sense of it. The other part of the setting of this book is that the book takes place after a near-death experience that the scrivener himself has undergone a heart surgery. And he returns, in a sense, from the world of myth, the world of death, the world of timelessness, back into the world of his own writing. And then finally, Homer discovering the alphabet, which for Homer changed everything. There's a wonderful book by Albert Lord called The Singer of Tales, in which he recounts everything that happened in Yugoslavia to him and another ethnographer named Milman Parry. They went out into the rural areas of what was then Yugoslavia, 1930s, and they recorded these oral renditions, recitations. And what they discovered was that bards were able to recite long, long, long passages, far more than we could possibly recite. And he speculated that perhaps this is the Homeric tradition, and that in fact we have 50,000 years at least of unrecorded oral tradition, which then is grafted or is the beginning of or the ending of one kind of consciousness when it meets writing. So To Banquet with the Ethiopians also touches on that thing that you and I know about writing. I mean, the fact is that writing itself is not an activity that one can contemplate with pure physical joy. It's, you know, cramped back and bad coffee and terrible lighting and squinty eyes. It's not like dance or singing. It's a separate activity. Recollected in tranquility is what Wordsworth says. And in a sense, what I'm trying to do in this poem is go back to that place when lines were conceived and spoken in one breath. That, in other words, when that sense of unity, that mythic unity of the ever-present now, was part of the world, was the world.
I'm curious also, what our viewers can't see is that you're not reading from anything. You do have all of this, you're reciting all this sort of from memory. Does that connect to sort of this tradition that you're talking about? Is that the reason that you decided to memorize your pieces, or is that something that you usually do?
Yes, it is part of that tradition, Lauren. And in fact, I don't think it was so much a decision as a kind of a shaping of the mind. I grew up with the Catholic Mass, and this was in the day when it was in Latin, and I was an altar boy. And so I was introduced to mysterious language, into utterance, if you will, at a very early age. No one knew what the Latin meant, but we learned it. And you learned it through the oral, that's A-U-R-A-L, the oral imagination. It comes in through the ear. And also I grew up, my parents were from Ireland, and I grew up in Queens, New York, listening to this strange music that they played on the phonograph record, the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makeham, which was full of utterances and sounds that made no sense, but which I took in. And in many ways, I think that has shaped my posture toward poetry. For me, making poetry, not just writing it. I write poetry largely because I don't have enough memory, and I could never remember it all, and I enjoy having it on the page and then reflecting it back into the mind. But the primary purpose is to change the shape of the mind, to change the synapses through the agency of sound.
Interesting. Can you, I guess, recite us some more from the collection?
Oh, I'd be delighted. Yeah, you know, this little section here is an introduction to a book where Homer is first encountering the alphabet, and it's called Redaction. And I'll just do a little bit of it. But the introduction calls to mind the litany of all the people who've come after Homer and the writing that they did, and in a sense, how all of that, to me, all of this tradition, this the last 3,000 years of our writing that we do, is in some ways a long elegiac wail to bring together for a time when, as I say, lines and were conceived and spoken in one breath. So this is the beginning of Redaction. Twice notched, figured with cave runes, generations of eyes and blistered hands labor over lines. In the mouth, a faint metallic tang, iridescent as the wings of the emperor dragonfly, great Achilles pinched out of the air and gnashed down. Lines of Yeats, of James Wright of Martins Ferry, Ohio. Lines of Catullus that once drowned my heart. Terza rima of Dante, Vion's ink welts, and the cosmic, breathless strophes of Neruda. Lines braised on a jewel-encrusted page, or zigzagging like mad Odysseus plow. Numbers metastasizing from my list, spiraling down into oblique lines of cereal boxes. Scripture of Bloomingdale's. Louisville sluggers branded mantle in burnt umber. And the everyday paper trails of my father's paper planes. The mind stays cowled under the moon. The tongue is laden with metallic wings that can't be swallowed, or if swallowed, can't be sung. This is how it is without the child rocking in the house of his own making. Sharp-edged verbs piercing bronze syntax, each fresh enjambment spurting blood, countless lines under the tireless sun, foot to spondy foot, unwilling to yield. And this is how it must have been the morning after the night of the naked burning girl when Homer, dazed with longing and lost love, tore open the package, and his mouth went silent, and his silent eyes opened on a strange horizon. And then Homer comes upon the alphabet. And what he does with it is everything, in a sense, that we have done. He discovers plot. He discovers distance. Because when you are making something, you're actually involved in it. When you're writing, there is a distance between you and what's happening. So all of this is part of, I think, our modern sensibility.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Philip Brady, reading from To Banquet with Ethiopians, a memoir of life before the alphabet. So there's a lot of things, Phil, that really interests me about this project. For instance, you're talking about chapters. What made you come to that decision? Also, when people do sort of a project of poems, a book that's assembled sort of like a project, I'm always interested in what comes first, the poems or the idea for the project. So maybe you could talk a little bit about those things.
Sure, actually, and be quite frank about it, it came out of failure, Lauren. It came out of terrible failure.
That we do.
What was happening to me? You mentioned Etruscan Press. Well, I've been now working as the publisher of Etruscan Press for almost 15 years, and one of the things that happens when you're a publisher is you're reading a lot of wonderful manuscripts, and they're coming to you differently than books come to you. Books come to you, and you could take them or leave them, and you put them back, and they're nice, and you appreciate them. Manuscripts come to you asking for something, asking for publication. And your posture toward them is, how to put it, to some extent, it begins almost adversarially. And so what I found happening to me was that I was reading American, I had my finger, so to speak, in the river of American contemporary poetry, and it is an extraordinarily rich river. And I began to feel that sitting down at my own desk writing a poem after reading some of these, you know, wonderful finished things which were coming was becoming more and more difficult. And so I had written a memoir. I had written a memoir called To Prove My Blood, and I decided to write a sequel. And I had hundreds of pages, Lauren. I had hundreds of pages of material, you know, drafts in prose, and it was sitting there, and it wasn't being threatened by all this great poetry that was coming across my desk. And then I had an event, a life event, a heart surgery, triple bypass. And when I came back, and this is 2010, I came back from that, and it was months of recovery. And a lot of people say after this that they're depressed. I wasn't really depressed at all. I was actually very dreamy. I was home. It was winter like this. I was in front of the fire. My wife was at home. And I looked at this memoir, and I saw that in many ways I had become completely separated from it. It was outside me. And then I started to translate it into poetry, translate it into pentameter, a common, you know, kind of English, sturdy English verse. And what I saw was that in translating from chapter to chapter, that what I was able to do is enter into the poem, both its oral structure and its mythic sense. Because when you're writing in sound clusters, you're not writing for the eye, and you're not writing necessarily in a linear way. Speed in a poem is very variable. You can move very quickly through a line, and then you can go deep into it. So the texture, I think, is much more multidimensional. That's what poems call attention to, the multidimensional texture in order to vary speed. So that's what happened.
When you're doing that, when you're editing for speed or sound, does that free you up from the confines of narrative?
Very much so. That's it. You know, that's exactly right. And in fact, one of the things I was doing at the same time was I was reading a lot about this, the oral tradition, and about Homer and all this. One of my favorite quotes is from another man who took on a project like this, but one accomplished at the highest level, Derek Walcott, who wrote a book called Omeros, which is a kind of retelling of the Homeric tales in the Caribbean. And he says, if you see art as simultaneous, then you see Joyce as a contemporary of Homer. And that was the breakthrough, just the idea that I realized that I didn't have to tell the story plot point by plot point. I just had to tell its psychic pitch. If I can give you one more seminal quote that I got from a man named Timothy Finley, and this really set me onto this quest. He said, I did not know how to tell this story, but I realized that if I were Homer, I would see that it is not merely the story of men and women, but of men and women and the gods whom they obeyed, and thus told best as an evocation of icons. Thus, I translated this story, which is history. I transposed, I should say, this story, which is history, into another key, which is mythology. And I think that's what I was doing in transposing my prose memoir with all of its information and all of its accuracy into the world of myth, where there isn't a whole lot of fidelity to actual factual events.
Right. I think a lot of memoir is rooted in myth, though.
I do too.
I mean, the retelling of stories, a mythology emerges. It just, I think it's natural. It has to at some point. We can't have all this accuracy, especially as we get older and we think back to our lives. It's sort of like Mark Twain says, we can remember it whether it happened or not. And it's sort of like, well, it's an imagination at this point, our memory. Can you recite some more?
Sure. Lauren and I were both involved in an MFA program. And so we had the experience of the workshop.
Oh, the wonderful workshop.
And so part of this poem is really just having some fun. And in this little section, Homer goes to a workshop because he's now learned to write. But he's got to go through the whole initiation process. And he winds up in Queens, New York. And he's at a bar called Homer's Famous Sports Emporium. And he goes to this symposium. So I just thought I'd share what happens when the Iliad is workshopped. The symposium's upstairs, 8 sharp. When Homer's shadow darkens the threshold, the milling ebbs. All fine seats in the conference room, in the long table in conference room 2A, Priam's throne, featuring authentic memorabilia, treasure chest murals, and boar tusk helmet wall lamps. Beneath the sword blade ceiling fan, Homer finds a tuffet at the foot. Tonight's symposium subject is called, Professor Alghieri checks the page, The Iliad, I believe, a memoir. Fred Nietzsche's walrus stash pouts. His fingers furiously collate, staple, deal. The symposiists lean forward, chins in palms. A moment's silence stretches for eons. But promising. It shows promise, chirps Al Pope. His purple finger taps the mimeo. But such infelicitous expression. Bowels? Black blood? Goat cheese? Knife? A tent? Dick Lattimore mutters, inconsistencies. Here the ships are black. Here tawny. Did you ever actually see a ship? The would-be laureate, chirps Tom Elliott, evinces a weak grasp of prosody. Simone Veil quells her strabismus to level a fierce gaze at Tomcat. These women are simply forced to come and go. It seems, says Pub Virgilius from underneath his Red Sox batting helmet, the author ever favors the losing side. Does he perhaps harbor a secret grudge? The victim bites his tongue. His gaze shifts from Chaucer's eye tick to Chris Logue's bronze earwax. He's been chided. Don't talk until the workshop is closed. So it goes on, and we have Ezra Pound and Mick Foucault, and finally, in this fantastical workshop, James Joyce comes. And this chapter is called Night Town, and Joyce comes and tells Homer, don't worry about the workshop, come downstairs with me. And of course, Ulysses features the great chapter on Circe, in which Stephen Dedalus descends into the equivalent of Hades, which is a Dublin cadre of town, Dublin Cartier, where he and Buck Mulligan get drunk and Leopold Bloom saves Dedalus and so on. And so that scene is maybe something that I would end with. This is from Night Town, and it's after he's had a few drinks. Homer and Joyce have had a few drinks together in this club, and the muse, who had been part of his own being, and that's the point in the world of myth, the muse is inside you. Well, now the muse comes to him in the figure of a woman. And then in a cloak of fire, she appears. If verse were conceived and spoken in one breath, this child of distant Troy with his notched vowels would undulate through grottos and owl groves, immersed in cascades of auburn hair. His tongue would surf the crest of an earlobe, lick the aureole of a ringed nipple. He'd rock and chant her many-tinted crown. But all Homer has are sentences that never move or speak, bound in skin, open in daylight, open alone. Impossible to claim she is and isn't visible and deep inside his skull. Impossible to name or even feel the surge of coastal nape, the crescent hip, slouching by Telemachus's royal or wandering a lonely foreign beach. Never had Homer seen a naked woman. Pieces, yes, revealed, suggested, sliding around surreptitious glances. But this encompassing, unveiled, the lip of sea and sky blurring to crest, wine cup and moon, carnal and immortal, consubstantiated in the chirograph of utterance that never was unsealed. Maybe he could fake the pillow talk, double entendres, sallies, half-truths, maybe the furniture and bed, even perhaps the legs. But no bars and squiggles could express the glistening ruby tympanum inverted at the vortex of the goddess who had once composed a rocking house inside his voice.
The poetry of Philip Brady. Thank you so much for being here, Philip. That was great.
Thank you, Lauren. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody may also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.